The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this week we're casting our critical eye on social media. What can we learn about ourselves by looking at our activities on Facebook and Twitter? And what can we learn about different cultures by looking at how people around the world use the web? Richard Allen is Facebook's Director of Policy in Europe. On this podcast, he predicts the future of social media, content sharing, and interactivity, talks about Facebook's legal policies and its security measures against governments that want to censor debate. He says that Facebook wants to be a platform for open debate, including discussion of political issues. And Bernardo Huberman from HP Labs shares his insights into what the 140 million users of the Chinese version of Twitter, known as Sinai Weibo, want, need, and gossip about. These stories, plus all the rest of this week's technology news, coming up in Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Time for this week's tech news headlines with Jemima.
There's really only one story to look at in this week's news, the announcements made on Thursday by Hewlett-Packard. Whilst outlining a £6 billion takeover of British software company Autonomy Corporation, HP also revealed it would look to spin off its home PC business and that it would be killing its line of smartphones and the 49-day-old tablet, the HP TouchPad. So many things to dissect here. The transformation of HP from a personal computer business into a business services company. The sad death of the critically acclaimed WebOS. And the tablet effect on computing. How the future of computing is being shaped by devices like the iPad. But before we get to that, let's go through some of the detail first with telecoms correspondent Juliet Garside and tech editor Charles Arthur. Juliet, can you tell us a bit about HP's bid for Autonomy and what they do? Who are they?
Autonomy are a Cambridge-based software company, and they specialise in very, very clever search, so much cleverer than Google in some ways. They can recognise sound, emails, video, and they're used by, for example, large companies. Say a company needs to trawl through its entire database, including all the emails, because it's got a legal case. They're used by intelligence services that want to monitor hundreds of television channels. Sometimes they're used in call centres to prompt operators in what to say next.
And why? What is HP's interest in Autonomy? Why do they want to buy them? Is it about making HP more competitive or moving into a particular sector?
Well, if I read you out Autonomy's client list, we've got Boeing, Ford, Daimler, Chrysler, Shell, AOL, the world's largest companies, the BBC. It's a way into providing services to those companies.
Is it a good buy, though? Because last year, Deutsche Bank analysts thought that Autonomy was more like a startup than a major player.
Yes, not in terms of the potential of the company, but it was a criticism of the chief executive, Mike Lynch, by someone who had been head of investor relations for Autonomy. And his view was that the top layer of management very tightly controlled the company. There wasn't much of a middle layer. You could say that's a very tightly run ship. Mike Lynch has had a fractious relationship with British investors and analysts over the years. He feels that British tech companies don't get the same support as their US counterparts.
I mean, I've encountered Mike Lynch down the years since about 1995, I think. Back in those days, as well as building up Autonomy as a sort of an enterprise company, he was looking at sort of the consumer focus, but he just gave up on the consumer focus. He couldn't find any real traction there. But he got his angel investing, I think, from someone in a pub, if I remember rightly.
£10,000 from a music executive.
Yes, exactly. I knew my memory hadn't failed me yet. But the interesting thing has been that he's always found it difficult to get the right attitude from British investors, to the extent that he found that he had to set up a Silicon Valley office to get investment out there. And he said, you have to sort of present yourself as an American company, even though he knew all the smart stuff was being done back in Cambridge in the UK.
So, Charles, this is about changing the shape of Hewlett-Packard. Can we sort of relate this to IBM's shift out of personal computing in 2005?
Well, yeah. Well, IBM sold its PC division in the end of 2004 to Lenovo, which at the time was a big surprise. But looked at retrospectively, it made complete sense. IBM just wasn't making any money actually selling PCs, even though they were, you know, critically acclaimed. People said, you know, the ThinkPad, fantastic piece of design. But the trouble was that there just wasn't any profit in it. And what IBM realized was that it could make money from services, which is actually what it had been doing down the years for the decades, making big mainframes, which it would then service for people, and it would make stacks of money off doing that. So IBM transformed itself very effectively into a services company and avoided a near-death experience. Now, the thing with HP is that last year when HP bought Palm for $1.2 billion, the chief executive was a guy called Mark Hurd, who had taken over from Carly Fiorina. And he was, I think, much more in tune with the HP heritage, if you like, of a sort of an innovative company which would build things and groovy ideas, and they'll be out there and change the world. The guy who's taken over came from SAP, is Leo Pothica. SAP is a sort of middleware company. It's for big enterprises. It's much more about enterprise-focused stuff. And he's turning it into a services company. He's basically emulating IBM here.
Julia, is it going to work?
Well, I can certainly say it's good to get out of PCs. Charles and I were looking at the numbers earlier, and the profit margins on PCs are tiny. I've seen it reported that they make, on average, a $40 margin on a PC. That's the kind of margin that can evaporate.
I mean, if you reckon that they sell about 48 million PCs a year, going by the Gartner figures, the Personal Systems Group, which is the bit that sells the PCs, per quarter does about $9.6 billion. And that's from selling, say, 12 million PCs. The profits actually work out to around, $40 profit per PC. The thing is that the Personal Systems Group is the biggest part of HP in terms of revenues, but it's got one of the smallest profits. I mean, compared to the Imaging and Printing Group, which is all your expensive printer inks, it's about two-thirds the size in terms of revenue, but it's about twice the size in terms of profit. And the services, which is its second biggest division, that's about $9 billion a quarter, but it makes $1.2 billion profit, and the Personal Systems Group makes about half that. So basically, the PSG bit is dragging the whole of the rest of the company down, if you look at it like that.
So we can see why that strategy was set in place. So, Charles, on WebOS, it was picked up by HP after they acquired Palm last year for £728 million. And their intention was then to develop smartphones based on Palm Pre and then move into the tablet market. How has it happened that in just over a year the company has decided it wants to get out of not just making tablets and smartphones, but PCs as well?
Well, I think it comes down to Apotheca, because Mark Hurd, I think, did have this consumer-focused idea that HP could sort of straddle both consumer and enterprise, that it would be part of the whole HP legacy. But Apotheca just doesn't see a future in that. And they gave WebOS and the touchpad a chance to succeed. But when people, weren't storming the stores to buy it, well, that was it. Its death certificate was signed within, I think, probably the first 2 or 3 weeks of it going on sale.
Is that really enough time to, to see if there's a viable market there?
I think you could argue that actually it is.
40,
I mean,
they'd made
a lot of noise. At Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, HP had a sort of an amazing corporate reception area where they were, feasting people, taking them down to sort of have very enjoyable sort of pink champagnes and things. And they were doing their briefing journalists there about how, focused they were going to be on the tablet. The European vice president was talking about how they were going to be number one plus. They were going to be, sort of like the iPad, only better. So, they put a lot of money into this. But I think they got no enterprise traction.
I do find it strange that given they want to spin the company off, so that means sell or float, essentially, they've already shut down the bits of it that are the most interesting, rather than leaving that in the hands of whoever is going to take it over next.
Well, they're sort of saying with WebOS that they're committed to it in the future. But if you're not making the hardware, well, okay, so you must be looking to license it. The only company that's any good at licensing software, 20 degree, is Microsoft.
But wasn't it going to run on printers and PCs as well? And that could have helped it increase reach.
Yeah, that was the sort of the vague suggestion, and possibly they might still do that, but it'd just be a rump, and it's not really $1.2 billion worth of value there.
Oh, are we talking when Apotheca talks about the tablet effect? Is he really only talking about the iPad?
He is only talking about the iPad. Absolutely, definitely. I mean, he mentioned it by name in the conference call about this, and the fact is still that the iPad just outsells everything else. I talked to Dixon's yesterday, and they were saying saying, you know, the iPad still outsells everything else by a mile.
But there were some reports that WebOS had been tested and ran really, really well on the iPad. So was it just that the software was let down by the hardware?
I'd like to see the video of WebOS on the iPad, because I can't quite see how you would get far enough into the internals to do that. It's a slightly different chipset from the touchpad. You know, you'd have to monkey around quite substantially. And the question would be, why are you doing this anyway? It's not as if Apple's going to let you do it. So, you know, I think there might be a report of that online, but I'd like to see the video.
And in the current climate, is it likely that WebOS might be valuable to any potential buyers because of the patents that...
Well, Palm had a couple of hundred patents, and it's not clear at the moment whether they would be very useful to anyone in the whole tablet space, because Apple, you know, pretty much has it. In fact, you know, I've been looking at a report this morning from Nomura, which suggests that peace is going to break out in the whole mobile market, that with Google acquiring the Motorola patents, with the expectation that deal is going to go through, you'll have Google, Microsoft, Apple, Nokia and RIM, who will all be well set up in terms of patents. Basically, there's no reason for them to fight now.
So looking ahead, where does this leave the computing landscape? Julia, is this the beginning of the end for the PC, and what we're really seeing is a shift to tablets and smartphones?
Well, you've got to ask questions about Dell at this stage. If you look at what Microsoft is doing and where it's spending its money on telephony, on Skype, on R&D with Nokia. And obviously, if you look at Google, that's also where it's spending its money. And they've got a big R&D team here in the UK, which specialises in mobile, but it's looking increasingly out on a limb when you realise that that's become the core of what the company is doing at the moment.
Charles, who would buy HP's personal computing business now? Can you name anyone in the running?
Well, Jack Schofield reckoned that Samsung would, though personally, I mean, yeah, the price tag that's been put on it, again, by Nomura is in the range of $10 billion to $13 billion. A lot of money to spend if you don't think you're going to be able to make the profit of it. HP clearly doesn't think it can get that. You know, at the sort of you know, profits that it's making off it, the $10 billion price tag, it would take you, you know, 5 years or more to earn it back. So I think that Lenovo is a possibility, Huawei is a possibility. You know, Samsung, I suppose, is a vague possibility, but I'm not sure that they need to. I think they could just soak up any, you know, spare capacity. And Dell obviously is going to be, I don't think will be a buyer, but they'll be expecting to soak up capacity from what HP doesn't do.
This does mean that fewer companies are going to be able to release a fully featured tablet with an app ecosystem, well supported at a competitive price. Isn't this move just really ceding the tablet market to Apple and the PC computing market to Dell?
Ooh, I think on the tablet market, I would say it's becoming a bit like the iPod market. You know, you have Android, which has got a very small ecosystem in terms of apps, you know, effective ecosystem in terms of, you know, people spending money on it. You know, I'm just not seeing people using Android tablets to do anything. I'm not hearing about enterprises buying lots of Android tablets, whereas the other day I heard about a big Windows house that's looking to buy thousands of iPads to deploy to its sales force.
Well, I'd say just from a really general consumer perspective, if you look at the reason people bought PCs at home, they bought, well, increasingly recently, they've bought them to watch YouTube, entertainment, information on the web. Now, yes, you can replace that with a tablet and do it more cheaply, or, and it's not commercial yet, but you'll be able to do it with a television. And so, you know, the PC's use within the home is being eroded. And if Google or Apple manages to make an internet television set that people can also do research on, check up, you know, web pages and use with ease and becomes scalable and, you know, a big commercial product, I think the role of the PC is just eroding, and then you've got the mobility offered by a smartphone. So I don't know, this might be the beginning of the end.
I think there's a faint question just about what happens with Windows, you know, with Windows 8 next year, which is expected to be able to run on tablets seamlessly. Will that make a dent in the whole iPad space? Will it make a dent on, you know, Android? You've got to expect that probably it will sell at least as well as Android, that there'll be some enterprises which will want to use it. But the whole question of how usable is it as a tablet rather than being a sort of a PC interface, I think that's still up in the air.
Well, thank you very much, Juliet and Charles. And as usual, there's plenty more analysis and coverage at guardian.co.uk/technology.
Each web evolution is encapsulated by a type of service. The first, pre-bubble in 2000, saw the emergence of information services like Google and Amazon that made sense of the content that rapidly saturated the network. The second, colloquially known as Web 2.0, injected the social onto the computerized platform, encouraging people to connect and to organize themselves. This era is typified by social networks like Facebook and Twitter, which recently have been attributed with galvanizing social movements from Northern Africa to the streets of London, Birmingham, and Manchester. Facebook's Richard Allen is the director of policy in Europe. He came into The Guardian to speak about the social network as a platform for political participation and for debate. Here, he explains why he thinks the internet, and particularly social networking, is important.
For a long period of time, the internet was used in this one-to-one model. It was me and a website. Nobody else was part of that conversation. The content on the website was the same, whoever I am, and was beamed back to me and was not shared with anyone else. Now, because of the scope of these interactions, whether you're gaming or sharing news and views, the addition of a social element is just more important. And the fact that you're doing it under an identity that enables other people to trust you is more important. So essentially, the internet has become too important for us now to be done as a fringe activity in the bedroom. It's something that's now, you know, part of your everyday life. We were used to, I think, for a period of time, think of the internet as something you did on a big screen on a fixed computer. Now it's something you do on big screens and small screens at the same time. So you use a service like Facebook on your smartphone, but you also use it extensively on the computer, and that ubiquity is there. So you can add the biggest screen of all now, the TV, probably to that mix as well. And you're using it across that whole range. So we did see, for example, in the last UK general election, very much a two-screen election. People would sit there watching, you know, the prime ministerial debates on the TV, following the news and commentary on their laptops while they're sat in the front room or on their smartphones. And that's going to become the norm. Our instinct is to create a platform on which people can debate legal issues freely. So we want people to debate whatever is of interest to them, including their political views. Most of the time they actually talk about friends and family, but they should also be able to talk about political issues and other issues on the site. There is a really interesting question about where the bounds of legality are defined, and that's not something that Facebook controls, it's something that national governments control. And we do need to say work carefully around that limit. We need to consider, I think it'd be wrong for us as a single internet service provider to be thinking about that. I think it's something that governments generally, international bodies and the internet sector as a whole needs to think very carefully around. In many countries, they have specific laws that outlaw certain forms of content. And actually, this is fairly universal. For example, in the UK, we have a law that allows organisations which in some way support terrorism to be outlawed, even if they're not actually terrorist organisations. And we had a row a little while ago about an organisation called Islam4UK that was doing very offensive protests at funerals of soldiers or corteges of soldiers that were being brought back from Afghanistan. That organisation was proscribed by the UK government and became illegal, but it wasn't illegal globally. It wasn't a terrorist organisation in the normal sense that would be illegal everywhere where we'd remove the content. And our response then is to then make the content that is only illegal in one country inaccessible in that one country where it otherwise meets normal standards. It's not just a Facebook issue, but all global web services are grappling with right now is the extent to which you need to comply with those local laws, the extent to which those local laws have popular support and a popular mandate that means, you know, it is reasonable to comply with them. And when you come to areas like the recent events in North Africa, you can clearly see that people were creating content on social networking sites that the then governments might have found unacceptable, but which had huge popular support and led to incredible outcomes. In the Tunisia case, people organized protests on Facebook. There was no attempt by the government to shut down specific forms of content. What the Tunisian government did was actually try to block access to services like Facebook as a whole. They also tried to intercept the communications of people using Facebook, and we took very robust security measures against that. But in that case, you know, the debate was allowed to flourish on Facebook. and we weren't confronted with a legal challenge.
Richard Allen from Facebook. You can watch that interview on the site at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. With the loss of their AAA credit rating, the US has been forced to admit that its days as the dominant global economic superpower are numbered. In its wake, analysts predict that by 2020, China will take its position in the top spot. So governments and businesses are now extremely keen to understand what makes that country tick. Now, one of the barometers of a population's interests is the output that it publishes online. Think about it. We can tell a lot about what the universe of Twitter users thinks is important by looking at what they're talking about at any one time. Well, the same could be argued for China's version of Twitter, Sina Weibo. Now that is the assertion of Bernardo Huberman, Senior HP Fellow and Director of the Social Computing Lab at Hewlett-Packard Laboratories, whose research team just completed an extensive analysis of the interests of 140 million people who use that platform. I recently spoke with Bernardo and began by asking him about Guanxi, which he describes as the nature of friendships and relationships in China.
There is a certain kind of obligation that you incur when you have a relationship with someone, a reciprocity of some kind, might actually change the way people were using social media. In particular, the Chinese do not use the notion of friendship the way we use it, precisely because of this Guanxi notion. So when we looked into Sina Weibo and compared to the findings that we had in Twitter and many other platforms that I've studied, we saw that the conversation appears to be of a different kind. It's not really a conversation among friends of the way we tend to think on Facebook and so on, and it's mostly just the ability to post an immense amount of content that actually has video and audio and comments on top of the standard, what we would call tweets in the West.
Are there any social media that do support this idea of Guanxi, of friendship as the Chinese conceptualize it or operationalize it?
Well, I've been told, I'm now relating what my Chinese interns here are telling me, that no, there isn't. And this is one of the reasons that, for instance, in China, they like to copy almost everything that we do here, there is no LinkedIn, because that Guanxi cannot be encoded very easily in a social network that is computationally based.
So how is Sina Weibo different from Twitter? What is the function, for example, and how is that different from Twitter?
In Sina Weibo, we notice that it's mostly jokes, discussions about cosmetics, things that at first glance seem to be, I don't want to call them superficial, but they have a content that is less portentous than it is sometimes on Twitter. Twitter has a lot of silliness and all sorts of other things as well. But we see in Twitter a very large source of the trends, the source, the original source is news media. Whereas in Sina Weibo, we do not see this. We see the bubbling of the stuff that gets to the top, the trending topics are very, very intrinsic to a young demographic. The Twitter demographics also started on a very young side of things and has shifted.
One of the aspects of the social platform that you investigated was to identify those people, not just the most important topics, i.e. the trending topics, but also those people who are most influential. Explain what that means, what you conceptualized as most influential within this? And then also, yeah, it would be interesting to contrast that with what the notion of most influential means in China.
Many people have decided that influence in this new medium is the number of followers or friends, which I don't think is a good measure of anything, or the number of retweets. And as I always say, people retweet anything. The activity of retweeting is almost like mental chewing gum. I mean, you just retweet something so your followers see it. So when we decided to study influence, we took into account what we call the passivity of the network. And the basic intuition here is, if you seldom retweet anything, and you were to retweet a tweet that I say sent to you, then I would have a bigger influence on you than if I were to send it to you and you're the kind of person that retweets anything. Okay, so that was the basic idea. This way, very quickly, we can sort out influence in a very different way than just the number of followers. And one of the things we found out in Twitter, people with very many followers are not necessarily the most influential. And conversely, sometimes people, few followers of order 200 or so, are among the most influential in Twitter.
So how does this map on to an Eastern conception?
Not easily. Influence is the ability to do big things for people. It's very hard to capture that kind of influence on a social network of the kind that we see on online. I think that there are the real social network, the real connections between people in daily life in any Asian countries or in Eastern countries. That is a very, very hard thing it's to translate into the online world. There are people that can do for you things that no one else can. And that is, of course, a tremendous measure of influence. When I talk to Chinese people about this, they tend to be rather reticent about it. It's something that is embedded in their culture, the way you grew up, but it's not something that they like to discuss, and they would not like that to be something that is explicit outside their own, you know, their own heads, basically, knowing who owes who and so on. As a matter of fact, when I asked, could you build a LinkedIn or the Chinese analog of LinkedIn, they said it's impossible because that's not the way you find a job in China. You just don't go through connections that you have with people you know. You go through the people that owe you something, that you establish this so-called guanqi.
Bernardo Huberman from HP Labs. That's all for this week's podcast. Next week, Tech Weekly is in Edinburgh, covering the Edinburgh Television Festival. You can see all the links from this program at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. The producer was Scott Colley, and I'm Alex Kratosky. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.